You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. This week, in this country, we're allowed to gather in groups of six in a garden. But we're keeping things sadly remote on the podcast. There'll be five of us communicating all from our living rooms, including, of course, Thea Leneduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello.
Listener's Corner, I've had some cracking emails over the week. and tweets. Mara G has tweeted in with pictures of her foster cats, Ulysses and Penelope. And they reminded her that a poem called When You Set Out for Ithaca is one of her favourite poems by Cavafy. Are you familiar with it, Thea?
Cavafy, yeah.
Cavafy. I know I was going to get that wrong. Cavafy. Just wait. There's a pronunciation minefield I'm about to be walking into.
I know, and it's just for you.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Cavafy has the anti-lockdown message. Hope your road is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery, which is kind of rather sad at the moment, isn't it? Elliot from Hungerford emails to say he and his girlfriend heard a dog owner on a walk call for three dogs, Edgar, Alan and Poe. Good, solid literary names. They also had a fourth dog. Less interestingly, for the purposes of this email, he says, and that was called Dora.
After Dora Maar, maybe, though?
Maybe. Or maybe just...
Maybe just Dora the Explorer.
Yeah. My little toddler Phoebe's middle name is Dora.
After?
Her grandmother, not a literary figure, alas, but yeah, her grandmother's called Dora.
It's a nice name.
Speaking of Dora, how about Nora? Alison Leave emails to say, when we took our Welsh terrier Nora to the vet for her first vaccinations, the receptionist insisted she needed a surname in the record system. Neither of us wanted Nora to have the other's surname. You can see that argument do anything. So she became Nora Barnacle after James Joyce's wife's. Isn't that brilliant?
That's excellent.
And of course, this means I'm now known as Mrs. Barnacle at the vet. Alison Lee, we salute you. That's absolutely brilliant. Okay. Fergus Leatham has sent this email. I was delighted to hear and see on Twitter that you've got yourself a little ginger kitten. I have, called Boudica or Boo. It's also pretty rare to get a female ginger cat, so well done on that. I hope you and yours will be able to treasure the little ginger ninja like we have, our very own literary pet, Winston, named in honour of Winston Churchill, who was ginger before he went bald. I'd hope he squeaks into the category of literary pets, given he was more prolific as a writer than Darwin and Shakespeare combined. I think we can allow Winston in, don't you think, to the literary pet pantheon?
I think we probably can.
He won the Nobel Prize for Literature, Winston Churchill, of course.
He did. I forgot that.
Yeah, and the whole Nobel Prize is, of course, as we know, baffling, but that is a baffling part of a baffling decision, it seems to me.
Yeah. E.M. Forster, who we're going to be talking about in a bit, was nominated something like 20 times, wasn't he?
Never got it. And Nabokov never got it, despite being nominated several times either. It's crazy. Anyway, Winston, the non-Nobel laureate cat, is a rather old fellow now, and here he is enjoying the warm weather in the garden. Sent me a picture. Lovely. Now, Thea, as pronunciation guru...
Not taking this for you. You've got to do this.
I'm going to do this.
Okay, good.
The email from Henk Eswies, which I've already probably got wrong. I listen to the TLS podcast every week when cleaning the bathroom.
Charming.
So much more enjoyable. Anyway, well done, Henk. Anyway, a few years ago, we got three hens, which are children named after characters in famous Dutch children's books. Mevrouw Helderder, Arge en Janneke, They're taken from books by Annie M.G. Schmidt, who wrote several classic children's novels in the 60s and 70s, such as Pluck van der Petterflet and Yip Ein Janneke. In her books and many songs, the kids are independent and capable, whereas the adults are often the wacky ones. I wanted to bring this to your attention as part of the ongoing literary pets theme and hope you will mention this on the podcast, if only to give me the pleasure of hearing you pronounce the names.
Damn you, well, cleaning the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yep. A couple more. David Moore's email with an actual literary dog. I'm not sure this counts. The title character and narrator of Leon Rook's 1981 novel, Shakespeare's Dog. Are you familiar with that, Thea?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll allow this, won't we?
We will allow. Yeah, are you familiar with the book? He sent us a picture of the cover, which has a dog in an Elizabethan ruff.
What more could you want?
Which I quite liked. And literary children. Remember the challenges now. We've moved from pets. Keep your pets coming in. But we also want literary children. And Nicholas Moran said, now that I learned teenagers are considered pets for the purposes of the section, I propose my 15-year-old daughter, Kedda, named after a minor character from Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast trilogy. Kedda, which I hope I'm pronouncing right, comes to live in the castle for a time, helping to raise Titus in the first volume.
So there you go.
That is a good literary pet. So, literary child.
The confusion continues.
It does. So children and pets. Let us know details of them and anything else, books you're reading, what you're watching. Tweet us at the TLS, at Stigable, at Thea_Leonarduzzi, or email me at stig.able@the-tls.co.uk. Get subscribing to the TLS this week. Use this special offer code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet. 6 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up on this week's show, it's 50 years since the death of E.M. Forster. And we've got two lovely pieces in the paper this week. Robert Douglas Fairhurst has rewatched all the Merchant Ivory adaptations, and Elizabeth Lowry has reread A Passage to India. Michael Caine's The Doctor, our literary guru, will be here to talk us through both of those pieces and E.M. Forster more generally. We continue our dispatches from lockdown around the world with the poet Alicia Stallings, who is coming to us from Athens. And Colin Grant is here to discuss a history of Jamaica, an island with a devastatingly cruel history and an extremely strong cultural reach.
The outsized global importance of Jamaica, an island nation with under 3 million citizens, is a subject of a recent book by Orlando Patterson called The Confounding Island. Slavery, Patterson contends, explains much of modern Jamaica's excellence, as well as its dysfunction. And while this isn't an original observation, the details and depths of Patterson's research make the book worthy of further discussion. For that, we're joined by Colin Grant, whose review in this week's TLS guides us through several hundred years of history and culture, dysfunction and excellence, from the cry of Anthony Trollope visiting in 1859, that the utter sinking of Jamaica under the sea might not be regarded as a misfortune for the British, to the rousing lyrics of the Wailers, who sang in 1973, "Slave driver, the table is turned, catch a fire so you can get burned." Colin Grant joins us on the line now to tell us more. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
It's a wonderful and very far-ranging book and your piece as well. And the image of a ruined Eden comes across as a very long established and persistent one when it comes to Jamaica.
I mean, it was regarded as the pearl of the Antilles. If anybody has been there will confirm with me that it's the most beautiful island, one of the most beautiful islands on the planet. It's very lush, very fecund, very fertile. But it's been ridden and riven with so much violence over the years that's slightly tainted, well, more than tainted, this former Eden. It's a very brutal country in many regards, unfortunately.
I suppose the question as well of a ruined Eden, the question follows, you know, ruined by whom, for whom?
Well, it is a plunder colony. It is an island which the British plundered, and they did so by bringing enslaved Africans to Jamaica, with one purpose, to make money off their backs through plantation culture. And make money they did. I mean, it created enormous wealth for a small number of British slavers and drivers and itinerant workers, but also absentee landlords. So for many, many years, it was the sugar in the bottom of the cup when it came to when many people bring in Britain drinking tea, but also it had enormous results in terms of wealth for the people who had these enslaved people on these massive plantations in Jamaica.
How does Patterson set out this central contention of Jamaica as confounding, you know, surprising, confusing?
It's a very small place, really, Jamaica. It's only 120 odd miles by 60 or 70 miles. Presently, it has less than 3 million people. But culturally, it really punches above its weight. It's a small place, and yet we have so much of our culture in this country has been informed by the excellence of reggae, which is primarily a Jamaican cultural export. In terms of language, I mean, if you walk around London, as I do, you'll hear Jamaican speak, you'll hear patois, sometimes spoken on the lips of new coming Polish migrants. So Jamaica is always and has been for many, many years thought of as a place of cool. But also it has great sporting achievements, which also bring Jamaica to a great worldwide prominence. One only has to think of Usain Bolt and some of those amazing cricketers who excel, especially in the 70s and 80s, people like Michael Holding. So Jamaica has, more than any other island in the Caribbean, forged a huge reputation culturally. Unfortunately, it's also forged a huge reputation in terms of the violence that is present and has been present in the country for many, many years.
And is there a reason given, Colin, for that cultural reach, first of all? Because the violence, you can probably draw a straight line between a sort of violent and bloody past and a violent and bloody present. There's probably arguments to be made around that, but you can see a link of sorts. What's the reason given for why Jamaica has excelled so much culturally, why it's had such reach?
I think, Stig, because it is a place where individualism is celebrated. If you can imagine in a place like Jamaica, where most people have very little money, have very little opportunities, and their prospects aren't great. The one thing that you can have, which can't be controlled, is style. So there's a great premium placed on style in Jamaica, and a great premium placed on your ability to create something out of nothing. There's a lot of mimicry going on, but also there's a lot of competition culturally. So in a way, I think that the constraints and the poor resources has led to people being very, very creative. But this is element of showmanship, of performing beyond the limits that are expected of you. And that's been the case for hundreds of years. And it's borne out, I think, especially in the music.
It's interesting. You observe at one point near the beginning of your piece how respect tops the list as the most important word in the Jamaican lexicon. It seems like a particularly rich and resonant one that kind of ties in with this idea of styling yourself in such a way as to elevate yourself and set yourself apart.
Yes, absolutely. And this notion of respect has been there right from the end of slavery. I mean, if you imagine over hundreds of years, there was the disrespect of slavery. The first thing that came out of emancipation was this idea that now people should be respected. And in the immediate aftermath of slavery coming to an end, everybody started calling themselves Mr. and Mrs. And you see that if you go to Jamaica, as I do regularly, and you get into a cab and you might get into a friendly conversation with someone, you might say to them, well, what's your name? And they'll say, my name is Mr. Thompson. They won't say my name is Colin or Bob or John. They have this
really
notion of respect embedded in them. It's right from the word go. And that's true also of the idea that you respect your children. So when I go, I've been going since I was a teenager, and whenever I went to Jamaica, I was always called Mr. Colin. So this notion of respect is very, very important. And I think it's quite enlivening for people. It gives them some sense of their importance and worth beyond that which is expected of them.
What do people say to you, Colin, when you go back and you say you were born in England, you talk about England? What's the view of Britain when you go to Jamaica? I mean, you obviously can't speak for an entire nation, but the sort of conversations you have, do they, because, you know, in this country, we should be more conscious of Windrush than the second Windrush scandal, the problems that our country has caused. Is there, what's the view of Britain over there now?
Well, it changes according to the generation of people that you speak to. Certainly the older generation, of my parents' generation, who are in the 80s and 90s now, they still see the world through the prism of Britain. So to give you some examples, my mother and father, who were born in Jamaica, when they were growing up in the 1940s in Jamaica, whenever there was a film played at the Rialto Cinema in Kingston, the capital, people would stand up to sing the British national anthem. And the same was true when the film came to an end. People would stand up to sing the British national anthem. You will talk to people who have left and gone back to Jamaica, and they'll say that when they first came to England and they went to the cinema in the 50s or 60s and stood up at the end of the national anthem, they were alone doing so, and they were confounded by that. They were bemused by that. So there's a sense that actually Britain has been rather an idea that you want to attach yourself to. So many of the people of my parents' generation were brought up with the romantic poets wedded to their souls. I mean, my mother can recite Gunga Din to the cows come home, and she knows all about Wordsworth and Shelley. They can recite these poets verbatim. But subsequent generations feel less inclined towards celebrating the connection with Britain. I think there has been over the years this notion that there ought to have been some reparations made towards Jamaicans for the plunder of Jamaica by the British. Certainly there's a kind of seething hatred, I would say, on the part of some people towards Britain for the wrong that has never really been addressed. In the piece, I talk about the fact that at the end of the enslaved period in the 1830s, the slave owners were rewarded to the tune of £20 million, but the enslaved were not. They were not in any way rewarded for the fact that they had brought this great wealth to this country. So that great disparity is something that sticks in the craw of people. And you can hear it actually, even in the lyrics of the songs that I quote in the piece, are not that atypical. But when Bob Marley, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer talk about in their song, Catch a Fire, slave driver, the table is turned, catch a fire, you're gonna get burned. That's a tale of revenge. And I think you hear that kind of notion that the yearning for revenge, for the yearning for some redress to the great wrong of slavery is still there. And I feel that when I go to Jamaica now, but also as you alluded to, earlier, Stig, people are really insulted by the disrespect shown to their elders who came to this country as British citizens and then were wrongly classified as illegal immigrants and booted out. So when you boot out those people, you're also showing disrespect to the Jamaicans back home. So they feel the shame of that transgression very deeply.
You know, we have a piece next to yours, I think, in the paper, which is talking about America, but it's reviewing a book about what lessons can be learnt from Germany. And the argument is advanced that the way Germany has responded to its genocidal past, its notion of the reparations it needs to make, it's the public apologies and the public regret and the need to recognize the ills of the past in Germany. If you contrast that with, say, America, currently aflame as we know, but also Britain, it makes the same point. The book's called Lessons to Learn from Germany, that Germany has, in some respects, managed to face up to its abysmal past in a way that, say, America and really, therefore, Britain has not.
No, I think that's very true. I'm born here. I'm born here, as they say. And by the way, the people in Jamaica feel sorry for me when I say I'm from Britain. I was born here. And when I was a young boy growing up in Luton, not very far from London, in the 60s and 70s, the idea that I was given as a child at school about slavery was that thank God for the British who brought about the end of slavery.
Yeah.
Thank God for William Wilberforce. So it was couched as a triumph. It was not couched as a period of disaster, as a period of great transgression on the part of the British. So there is this notion, actually, that the British, they did a great number on people like me, but also on my parents' generation, because even they didn't really focus on the negativity of slavery. And they, in a way, wanted to distance themselves from that notion. And by cleaving to Britain, to an idea of the people who were successful in this period, they neglected, or rather they turned their back towards Africa. So it's only, I think, in the last 50 years that people have begun to think of themselves in a more Afrocentric way in Jamaica and turned against Britain. I mean, when my parents were growing up, it was very much the tradition of Anglophilia, and they called themselves Afro-Saxons. It's also, unfortunately, wedded to this notion of it being a very sad thing to be black. It was the tradition. There's a man called Vivian Durham, a very fine journalist, who in the 50s said it was the tradition of every black person in Jamaica to be white. And that just speaks to the kind of propaganda that the British invoked in order to introduce this negativity about the colour of the majority of the population. This majority population felt very poorly about themselves and wanted no more than to be like their white overseers or white colonial masters.
And the degradation that that does to a whole culture. I mean, you mentioned how your mum can still recite Wordsworth word by word. It reminds me of that Lucy by Jamaica Kincaid, where there's that scene where Lucy is in school and she starts reciting "I wandered lonely as a cloud," and having to uphold someone else's culture. Obviously then the whole of Jamaican culture that was being made, you know, day by day was completely suppressed.
Yes, I think so. What it means that is there's a lot of suspicion. My colour is brown, but when I go to Jamaica, because of the way that I sound and because I drive a hire car, it is assumed in some regard that I am part of the oppressor. I'm part of the people who've been victorious when it comes to plundering the country. And so there's this tension also, even in the island between the haves and the have-nots. And that's still not been resolved. And that's still, I think, as Orlando Patterson points out, one of the terrible legacies of the Atlantic slave trade and of the British colonial rule.
Can we see then that reality, that feeling in sport as well? Because when I was growing up, and I presume when you were growing up, Colin, the idea of cricket, a sort of British game, was seen at the centre of the Caribbean. It was a great sport. The West Indies was great at cricket. Is it now the case that the cultural pull isn't British? It's not a let's play a game of the British. America seems to me, when you read about the sporting prowess of people in the Caribbean, they might be inclined towards basketball, they might be inclined towards American football or sprinting or athletics, things that where America has the center of gravity rather than Britain.
Yeah, I think that's very true, Stig. As you know, this great tradition of athleticism in Jamaica, and many young athletes who have any kind of prospect or show any promise are courted and tempted to go to America to take up scholarships there. The great heyday of West Indian cricket has slightly passed, I think, although there's still a great thirst and love of cricket as the great levelling field. The great thing about sport, isn't it, that you are judged purely on your merit. You know, you win or you lose. There's no way that the sport is rigged. So in a way, people can excel and not feel that they're going to be somehow challenged in their success. But if you go to Jamaica now, you'll find very few basketball courts. It's mostly, I'd say, American football is going to be the thing that takes off increasingly. And the continued interest and love of sprint events in athletics. And one of the things that intrigued me, and I never knew about, Stig, was the degree to which the excellence in athletics has been going on for over 100 years.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, and one of the things that Orlando Patterson does is skewer this notion of there being some sort of pseudoscience behind why black Jamaicans are more athletic and do better at sport than their white compatriots or white competitors. But in the book, Orlando Patterson refers back to a man called Alfred Downer, who was born in 1873. He excelled in Victorian England as one of the finest sprinters ever. Yet Alfred Downer, who was from Jamaica, but his parents were white. So they were either overseers or plantation owners themselves. What you get from that is a sense that the tradition yields success. I mean, he also goes on to point about the fact that one of the most prominent politicians in Jamaica in the 40s and 50s was a man called Norman Manley, who was a Rhodes Scholar. But also, Norman Manley was this fantastic athlete. who excelled when it came to university. He was a great sprinter as well. And Orlando Patterson makes the funny joke that imagine the impact of athletics in America had George Washington been a sprint champion. So, you know, there's a long tradition of sprinters, but it comes out of the fact that there's been this great interest in athletics and a great investment, both emotionally and financially, in the sport for over 100 years.
And interesting, too, in terms of how it's a fine example of how these myths that we tell ourselves about, you know, Jamaica this, Jamaica that, and we do it for other countries as well, but how these myths can become utterly, utterly detached from the reality. But they feed the narrative that we have, that we want to keep feeding.
Yeah, and it's difficult, isn't it, to divest yourself of those things that you've told yourself again and again and again. And that's one of the great things I think about Jamaica, is that although there is this great anger and a great feeling that there's been this wrong in the past, there's also this great capacity to forgive. So, I mean, Jamaica does have this terrible reputation for violence, but the violence is perpetrated by a small number of people. The overwhelming feeling that you get from Jamaica, even in the midst of this terrible agony of its past, is one of love. I mean, one love is the other phrase that you'll hear again and again over and over in Jamaica. And it's partly due, I think, to this notion of non-alignment that arose during the heyday of the Rastafarian movement and the excellence of reggae, which kind of went hand in glove with Rastafari. And so the idea of Rastafari, that God resides within you, I and I, they say, I and I, is a kind of peace-loving culture, peace-loving cult, peace-loving religion that actually has, through many, many decades, begun to inform the mainstream. It wasn't always the case. I mean, Rastafari was a vilified religion, and Rastafarians were outcasts in the 50s and 60s. No one wanted to be associated with. But with the ascendancy of Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer and Burning Spear and people like that, the fact that they became financially and culturally successful, Rastafari also was benefited from that new way of thinking about these poor, barefoot people who formerly had nothing to offer society. And somehow that kind of humility, that kind of sense that they're not too far removed from the humble origins, has somehow percolated throughout the country. So as well as there being this seething feeling for vengeance and for some sort of reparation, there is this amazing outpouring of love and affection whenever you travel in Jamaica.
Well, that's probably a point to leave it on, Colin, both the negative reality and also the positive one as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, we all probably have E.M. Forster in the canon, but where exactly? He never, it seems to me, is quite dominant, hovering stubbornly somewhere between major and minor. Robert Douglas Fairhurst this week reminds us that Strachey's nickname for him was Mole, which poked fun at his friend's short-sighted and whiskery appearance, but also acknowledged Forster's skill at vanishing into a network of hidden tunnels. He has never disappeared completely, and Douglas Fairhurst argues that in our new lockdown world, Forster's writing has started to resonate in even stronger, stranger ways. That's true of the writing. It's also true of the film adaptations made in the 1980s and 90s. Elizabeth Lowry, on the other hand, has returned to the novel A Passage to India, which itself seems to resonate with the present day. Forster's tale of the failing Raj is set into relief by our own signs of a diminished world. And to Lowry, there is little consolation in Forster's text. At life's core, where meaning should be, she says, there's a blank. Forster's final and long gestating novel is both the apex of his fiction and his dismissal of fiction itself. According to Lowry, the fact that there was nothing left to say and that not writing was the only truthful way of saying it. So what to make of Forster now? Has his time really come again, and did it really ever go away? Michael Caines is here to consider those questions and more. Michael, hello.
Hello, Steve.
Right. I realise this may be an unprofitable question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Michael. Is he a major figure? If you were to look at the century's major novelists, is Forster there? Is he a Hardy-esque figure, or is he sort of the league below?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's quite fair to ask, because we're halfway there to that strange figure, that round figure of 100 years after an author's death. Is he still being read? Is she still being studied? Are their works being published? And in the case of Forster, to me, he's a major figure, but I'm aware that not everyone holds that opinion. He's not an Oxford World's Classic, for example, but he is a Penguin World Classic.
He not? Oh.
It's very strange that, isn't it? I thought, I'm sure I've seen it, but I don't think he is. He did contribute to the World's Classics when it was being created in the early days, as did Wolfe, and they were working quite closely in association at the time. But I don't think he's been published as a World's Classic, so I find that quite strange. Anyway, that's just one sort of symptom, if you like, of being a major figure. And you mentioned the idea that maybe he's sort of somewhere between major and minor. And I wonder if the very popular films based on his work somehow contribute to that. Like, maybe they're very popular and they're heritage sort of films in the cliche way. And maybe that creates a bit of snobbery about his work, as does the sense that they're about ladies hanging around in Florence, which, of course, if people read them closely, they realise really isn't the whole truth about them.
And nothing wrong with that at all. You can make the same case about Henry James has lots of people faffing around Florence and Venice and places, and it's no cause for disgrace.
Wasn't there, in fact, some beef between E.M. Forster and Henry James? Didn't Forster think that Henry James had sort of ripped off Where Angels Fear to Tread in The Ambassadors?
Really?
I'm sure. Yeah, I'll have to look into that. But it's a similar plot line, isn't it? Because
it is.
There's, right, you know, young Lilia, the English widow, who kind of runs off to Italy and falls in love. And then her relatives are sort of trying to claw her back from beautiful, free Tuscany to stale old England.
So I didn't know that. I picture that as being something like Colin Firth and Hugh Grant having a...
Yeah.
Thing is, I'm all Team James in this era, I regret to say, Michael. I'm, you know, The Ambassadors is my, I think, possibly my second favourite Henry James novel. I think it's one. And Henry James is a major figure, isn't he? In a way that Forster...
You're trying to turn this into a podcast about Henry James. Yeah,
I'll shut up.
But that is a good question, isn't it, I suppose, in that if Forster is somebody who seems being a bit too light, but in some ways he has common ground with James, what is the difference? Does it lie in the prose, or in the way he doesn't maybe raise weighty concerns in the same way?
And you get Forster, that, and Forster, we end up with when the novel Morris comes out, which is after his death, and he's sort of seen to confront issues around homosexuality in a way that possibly Henry James could have done but didn't. There's even a point of similarity or difference there, perhaps.
It's very strange with Morris, isn't it? And the story collection, I think, gets overlooked, that came out around the same time. You know, also posthumously, this collection came out the year after Morris, called The Life to Come. And it clearly shows that Forster had been writing, you know, stories, been drawing on his own life and been imagining things that he knew he would never see published. So it's interesting maybe to put that alongside James, who is more... obviously infinitely more prolific, and knew exactly what he was doing when it came to getting publishable books out.
Well, that's right. Let's look at the career then, because it's perhaps surprising to me that Forster only published 5 novels in his lifetime. In your view, is it easy to say it's a kind of career building up to A Passage to India, which, as Elizabeth Lowry explains, took him years and years to write? The First World War intervened, but it did take him a long time. Is it the sense of the sort of the career building up to that moment?
There's a strange sense, to my mind, in which it's not really a literary career at all. I mean, he's a man of means. He doesn't need to work, and he doesn't quite know what to do when he leaves Cambridge. Somehow failed to receive a first, and so he couldn't stay. But he did go on and tutor and lecture, and he wrote non-fiction as well as fiction. And then those early novels, those sort of pre-First World War novels, he's working on them. I think it's, you know, he's picking up Room with a View, putting it down, and then working on The Longest Journey. You know, and so you can feel that there are a lot of similarities between them, because they're all emerging from this same kind of, I don't know, this mind that is doing this and then going off on travels to Italy with his mother and then coming home. And, you know, sort of the same kind of atmosphere that hangs around them. And then, as Elizabeth Lowry says, as you point out, it takes a long time to produce A Passage to India, and it takes a lot of help to produce Passage to India. So maybe you could say it's not a sort of building up to it. It's there's a kind of weariness, he says himself. I mean, she quotes this great line, doesn't she, that he's sort of weary about the conventionalities of novel writing. It's all a bit old hat to him at that point. But he does need help from people to sort of get across the line. And he writes 7 chapters, I think, of A Passage to India in 1913, just after he left. So he went to India in 1912 with friends. He left in the spring. He wrote a bit. And of course, he put it down again. The war happens. He becomes, he works for the Red Cross during the war. He has new sexual experiences abroad, and he needs lots of help from Leonard and Virginia Woolf, among others, to help him finish the novel. So it's a very strange shape, that part of his life. And then, of course, he lives for a long time afterwards and dies in 1970. He broadcasts. He ends up being treated as if he is a classic. You know, he gets to write forewords to his earlier books, looking back on them.
But it's kind of extraordinary that he never wrote a novel after that.
Yeah, it feels. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the Elizabeth Lowry's argument, but she mentioned something that I think comes up a lot in Forster criticism. I mean, that's my just sense from obviously the kind of outside of that, is that there is a nothingness at the heart of the novel, and maybe he has said something that needs to be said about the moral realism that he writes and about the limits of fiction as he can write it, not necessarily for the novel in a big sense, but for him personally.
It seems to tie in almost with what a point that Robert Douglas Fairhurst makes about how all Forster's most sympathetic characters want a view. They want to look out of a metaphorical window on have a larger understanding of life, an alternative future, and elsewhere, he says, where things happen otherwise. And it's almost like by the time he finishes or is writing A Passage to India, more and more of those narratives of empire, specifically the Raj, might have once seemed to represent all that possibility, you know, that there was this other place where people could, you know, prosper and be free and all of those things. And that was all kind of crumbling. And you do get a sense of like all of these narratives, these grand narratives in the case of empire and all of that, just crumbling and fading and being exhausted. And so it seemed almost natural that fiction would fail for him.
Well, on the other hand, I think that there is a view, but there's got to be a room. And he's a writer who draws on these tensions, that something can be, as you're saying, stifling and outdated and, you know, and oppressive for everyone. Ideas of empire, ideas of, you know, a man or a woman's place in society, or classes, the class system. You know, he sees all of that as bad. He wants to reject it. And I think he writes some various points about, you know, rejecting ideas of nationality, you know, these rigid boundaries that to some people are still absolutely defining. And he wants to get rid of that. And the view is the thing that matters, but somehow people still need rooms. So the tension in the novel maybe depends on having both.
I'm interested in both of your answers to this, which is, if you had to recommend a non-Forster reader a book to read of his, would you say go to A Passage to India? What's your favourite?
I think Room with a View has still got this kind of seductive holiday atmosphere that it also undercuts. So you get a sense of both, that he can describe, be a great pure travel writer. He can describe and relish the life of this place as seen by, you know, through a tourist's eye. But he can also cut against that and show how that in itself is this strange oppressive project. So I think that's quite a good one. Would anyone say something?
Well, I would say that one as well. But having read Elizabeth Lowry's piece, it suggests that, you know, rereading Passage is actually very well worth doing, because the lines that she pulls out make it seem like something that you should, you're really only going to get the maximum out almost, or not get the maximum out of, but that there is much more to be got out of it if you read it in conjunction with his critical writing, which is what I started with. I read aspects of the novel. And when you read those two texts in tandem, a passage and aspects, you see kind of this the togetherness of his vision. In musical terms, she says, A Passage to India is a John Cage composition. It makes not just a narrative feature, but a structural and ontological keynote of the silence at the heart of existence, which the novel usually tries to disguise. And then you remember, of course, that Forster conceived of the novel as a symphony. And that is what he wrote about in Aspects, where he spoke about rhythm and structure and character and plot and all of those sorts of things coming into the whole.
I also think it's interesting to read, to have a novelist whose output is so small you can read all of them. Relatively, I'm always attracted, Michael, we've spoken about this before, but one of the many attractive things about Jane Austen is you can read six novels, and putting aside the sort of marginalia and the unfinished stuff, you can read the whole of Jane Austen relatively easily. And there's something very satisfying about that, don't you think? That if it's four or five or six novels, it's not going to kill you to read them, and getting across the trajectory of someone's novel career is I think it's quite a thrilling thing to do.
I think in Forster's case, they come in they're in conversation partly because of, as I said, the time at which they're composed, the world to which they refer, and Passage to India is a kind of outlier, although it still, of course, includes these elements of what it's like to be, say, a British tourist abroad in the world. But they're also bound together by this theme maybe of a self-realization. And that includes something that I think Elizabeth Lowry quotes about most of life being about being able to look clearly at the fact that we exaggerate a lot about our lives. That we say, we might say, what is it? I'm having most fantastic time, or this is the most thrilling day ever. And Forster says, well, actually, you know, you might be having the most thrilling day ever, but there are going to be moments of boredom, moments of uncertainty, moments of doubt, fear, pain, whatever they are. But most of the time, existence just continues. I mean, this is quite a horrible, deflating realization. And we're being insincere when we kind of hype it up. That's just one way in which the novel is doing something, you know, remarkable, that is going on throughout his books. And so that maybe again cuts against the idea of there being a progress from Where Angels Fear to Tread and The Longest Journey, the first ones to be published, to India. I think it's all there, and it's kind of waiting to be sort of driven out, squeezed out.
Well I'm gonna go, I mean, I might read, are we all gonna go and read A Passage to India, reread it? Is that what's the lesson of all of
this? I don't think so. I think Elizabeth Lowry's done it for me.
All right.
She sold it to me. I'm going to reread it, I think, after this. I thought it's a great, great piece, and I hope people...
It is a great piece.
Yeah, lovely. Well, listen, I'm going to go and do the same. Michael, as ever, a joy to speak to you.
My pleasure.
I do hope readers of the paper have been enjoying our cultural dispatches from around the world in lockdown, from Germany to Western Australia, New York to Goa. This week we hear from the poet Alicia Stallings, who has written a beautiful essay about her nightly visits to one of her favourite Athenian haunts, the Proto-Necrotapheio, the first cemetery of Athens. It is a place not only of death, she says the dead have their 6 feet of social distancing down cold, but also of life, being both sculpture park and urban forest too, a home of swaggering cats and young boys stir crazy from quarantine who like to take their skateboards for a spin on the broad marble courtyard. To tell us about this fascinating place and life at the moment in Greece, Alicia joins Thea and me now. Alicia, hello.
Hello. I think Greece has been kind of lucky in the sense that it went on an early lockdown and seems to have squashed the curve of the virus. So it's kind of opening up a little now.
How does that feel? Because where we are in Britain, Greece is heralded as a country that's handled this well. Living there, did you feel that the government was handling it well? It was being tackled responsibly.
Yes, I think that they gave very clear instructions. They had an epidemiologist in charge of making a lot of these decisions, and who would give weekly briefings to the public. And I think there was a kind of public spiritedness coming out of austerity. There was this idea that people had to have each other's backs, I guess. Nobody wants to end up in hospital here because those hospitals are also, they were suffered under austerity. And we're very close to Italy culturally and maybe geographically. And I think people saw what was happening there and everyone took it very seriously. And Greece, in Greek, almost every wish that you do, whether it's saying hello or goodbye or cheers, all of that involves the word for health. I think that's one of the main virtues is health. So I think everyone took it quite seriously and they did a good job.
It's been something of a test as well, though, hasn't it? I mean, it's a relatively new administration. They'd been elected only last July, I think. So, I mean, not much more than 6 months in power before it had to start making these major decisions.
Yes. And I think, you know, even people on other sides of the political spectrum, they may not agree with some of the things they've done about refugees and migration, but I think everyone kind of agrees that they did a good job with the virus. So we're happy for that. We're now kind of in this strange period between having flattened the curve, but there are no tourists here yet. So the Acropolis is empty. I think Athenians are kind of enjoying having the city to themselves for a little bit before whatever will happen when tourists re-enter on June 15th.
Interesting, because in Rome, they've just reopened the Colosseum.
Yes, we only recently did the archaeological sites reopen, and the museums are still closed, but I think they also open shortly. So we're kind of hoping to visit a lot of these things while it still feels relatively safe and while we have very few people at them. I mean, it's been wonderful. We took the family up to the Acropolis. There was nobody there, which is unheard of on a beautiful late May morning.
And does that still excite you, Alicia, despite living there, despite being an adopted daughter of the country in a sense? Is it still thrilling to sort of walk around those sites?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think everyone in Athens sort of feels if you turn a corner and get a view of the Acropolis, that always gives you a little thrill. So we enjoy that. In fact, one of the strange things, secrets of the cemetery, there's a place where you can climb up and get a beautiful view of the Acropolis.
Well, tell us about this cemetery, because it sounds like a fantastic place. The first cemetery of Athens. Why did you pick there as a place to go?
Well, it was open.
It's a good start.
The archaeological sites were shut, but the first cemetery is also a working cemetery. So even though it has all of these storied figures who are buried there, from politicians to movie stars, poets to painters, sculptors, assassins. I mean, it has all of modern Greek history is in the soil there. But, you know, at the same time, it's a working cemetery, so it's open.
You say there's a great line in your piece, one could write a history of modern Greece through the funerals of poets. And you talk about several of those. What do you mean by that? What parts of modern Greek history do you think are encapsulated?
This is a little bit further afield from the first cemetery in Athens, but I would start with the funeral of Byron, or the death of Byron, right at the very beginning of the Greek state, at the very dawn, which was an enormously important event, so much so that Easter was postponed that year, as Easter was kind of postponed this year. When the Nazis were occupying Athens, Palamas, very important national poet of Greece, died. And at his funeral, Sikeliados, another important poet, gave a very rousing speech and read a poem. And there were 100,000 people present at that funeral, and it became a protest against the occupation. So likewise, when George Seferis died, it was still during the junta, and when people went to that funeral, it also became a protest against the junta. So there's a sense that the funerals of poets often has a political element.
And you talk about the funeral of Kiki Demula, which happened before lockdown as a kind of marker point of how a sort of the before coronavirus period, it was an end of an era.
It was a kind of strange thing. There were several deaths of important literary figures at the beginning of 2020, and those funerals were state funerals, often very well attended. I think there were a few hundred people at Kiki Demula's funeral, including, I believe, the president of Greece. many politicians, many figures, and everyone, just that memory of everyone kissing each other on the cheek and making jokes about, we'll see you at the next funeral. And within days, that just became almost unimaginable that anyone would greet people by kissing them on the cheek.
You mentioned the resistance hero, Manolis Glezos, the man who, as a youth in 1941, he scaled the Acropolis and tore down the Nazi flag. He died at the end of March too, and by that point, everything had changed. So he had only a very, very modest funeral, a few people. It sort of makes me wonder about what's happening, you know, what will happen to all this grief for the dead that we usually get a chance to air at the funerals of relatives or, in this case, important figures. You know, so many people aren't getting to exercise these really important customs.
I've been by his, I found his grave, actually sort of stumbled upon it by accident. There's no marker there yet. And I only knew it was his grave because there was a Greek flag there and there was a poem taped to a tree in his honor and a few flowers scattered on the bare earth. I think eventually there will be, the state will install some sort of marble monument. But one of the things I do like about the Greek way of death is there's a kind of natural rhythm to the mourning. So there is the funeral itself, but then there's, I believe, a 9-day memorial. There's a very important 40-day memorial. There's a very important 1-year memorial. There's a very important 3-year memorial. So I think that what will happen probably with Glezos, assuming the virus kind of stays under control, is that we will see something more populated at one of these marker events.
You mentioned that a poem taped to a tree. How much consolation have you found over the last, I suppose, what is it, 8 to 10 weeks? Have you found consolation in reading poetry, thinking where you are in classical poetry? Do you find that poems from a long time ago speak to you at the moment particularly?
Well, I think they always do. That's kind of their special trick, is they always seem to find a way to speak to the moment, to speak to the future. I translated Lucretius's De Rerum Natura, which has a long segment on the plague in Athens. It's basically a versification of Thucydides. I've been thinking about that a lot. And the cemetery itself is just full of poetry. People have poems inscribed on their tombs. So it's not only poets, but, you know, people might have a poem by Cavafy. They might have some verses from the Iliad. They might have some verses from more contemporary poetry. So I think it poetry does, I think one of the things it does is it says, you know, life was ever thus. This, you aren't the first person to go through disease or plague or lockdown or quarantine or any of these things, solitude. So I do find a lot of comfort. It does not feel lonesome in the cemetery. It's so full of interesting people. You'll turn a corner and suddenly realize, oh, so-and-so is buried here as well. And but it's also almost a nature preserve. It's full of birds. There are mulberry trees that the magpies are enjoying right now. There are cats everywhere. They're not exactly wildlife, but they're feral. And there's this wonderful feeling of nature going on about its business and time going on about its business. And I find that a consolation.
I do. That really resonates with me. I've always really liked, it's difficult to pull this line off without sounding odd, but I've always really liked cemeteries. I've never found them to be morbid places. There is, especially in the bigger, wilder ones that are overgrown, there is always so much life. But even if they're the tidy kind of filing cabinet style ones that you get a lot of in Italy, for example, there's always a sense of so much life lived, and it does make for good company.
I actually think one of the things you can do in Britain generally as well is, I do this all the time with my children, if you go anywhere, you find a church, you find a graveyard, you will find, you know, something going back 200 or 300 or 400 years. You find engravings that sort of tell a story, or a life cut short, or a life that was tremendously elongated, and finding stories in people, that it is oddly invigorating. Did you feel that, Alicia, even, you know, surrounded by this sort of mortal peril, you the fact that you could go to a cemetery and find life feels almost oddly appropriate?
Yes, and it is it was a beautiful springtime. So, you know, the blackbirds are singing. There's a wonderful fragrance of the bitter orange trees. I think my family was sort of amused because I would always return from this, you know, kind of cheered up to the cemetery. But there's a life even beyond that. There's the first cemetery is surrounded by marble workshops. So there are living artists who are making monuments. There's just a kind of a busyness about it. At the same time, I felt I wasn't close to crowds. I would be, you know, often almost the only person besides a few gravediggers walking around.
Gravediggers and skateboarders.
Skateboarders, yes.
It's an interesting societal overlap.
It is. Alicia, before you go, when we talk to writers on this, people are still pretty much still staying a lot at home. So is there a book or a poem or a film that you've watched or read or experienced during lockdown that you'd recommend? Because people may be coming to the end of their bookshelves and thinking of something. Is there anything that you've read over the last few weeks that you'd particularly resonate and you'd particularly recommend?
Well, I've been very interested in a reissued poetry debut from 1962 by Rosamund Stanhope. I think it's called As I Look Down from Camelot. I may have that title not right, but I've kind of enjoyed rediscovering these ornate and beautiful poems. That's been something I've enjoyed. And again, kind of connected a little bit to the cemetery. We finally managed to find the grave of T.H. White, author of Once and Future King, in the Protestant section. I'd been looking for it for years, but we finally sort of hit upon it. And I've been rereading The Goshawk, his very kind of harrowing description of manning this wild animal. And I think it doesn't end up going very well, but it's also about solitude because he's kind of quarantined himself. So it's strangely about confronting solitude and nature and all of these things. And I've been thinking about it, I think partly because of finding his grave and then reading it and sort of feeling that I'm in conversation with that.
That's a great recommendation. Alicia, thank you so much for joining us now.
Thank you so much.
I am enjoying the recommender. We get really a wide range of recommendations, I think, here. It's always worth asking the question. What was it? Sam Leith was talking about a Netflix comic thing. And then we have The Goshawk. It's a nice, I think.
Yeah, which sort of takes us back to Richard Smith recommended a bird book as well. I can't remember. We'll have to go back a few episodes to find it. But there's some dovetailing going on.
Dovetailing, indeed. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Michael Caines, Colin Grant and Alicia Stallings. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. This week we have everything from the father of American anthropology to a prose poem by a Portuguese writer to the love affair between Iris Murdoch and Brigid Brophy. Next week there's all sorts of things we could talk about, from May Gray to Napoleon to the art to see on the internet in lockdown. We'll see what we pick. Until then, from Thea and me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.